Welcome to the New Books Network.
Confounding, exhilarating, and contagious. Emotions matter, and so does applying emotional intelligence. Welcome to Dan Hill's EQ Spotlight, the podcast where emotions rule. Whatever the topic, how do hearts and minds collide? Find out with your host, a college professor turned globe-trotting EQ entrepreneur. His mission? Each week, Dan joins prominent authors in decoding how emotions drive outcomes and make people tick. Now, on to the show.
Hello, everyone, and thank you for joining me for the 85th episode of my podcast, Dan Hill's EQ Spotlight. The series appears here on the New Books Network, which has as its motto, sharing knowledge so people can thrive. Today's topic is, we're better together. I'm joined by Sarah and Larry Nannery. They are the co-authors of What to Say Next, Successful Communication in Your Work, Life, and Love with Autism Spectrum Disorder. The publisher is Tiller Press, which is an imprint of Simon & Schuster. Sarah is the Director of Development for Autism Initiatives at Drexel University. Larry is a technology consultant who focuses on organizational change and life coaching. Welcome to the show, both of you.
Thank you.
Looking forward to it. So if you don't mind, can we get a brief overview of the book, some sense of what it's about?
Yeah, sure. So I'm Sarah, and Larry and I wrote this book together. It was kind of something that came out of just our shared experience of me being autistic and Larry being what we call neurotypical, although he's anything but typical, and how we've been able to figure out how to communicate together as partners, as parents, and Larry has done a lot to help me figure out how to communicate professionally. So, you know, when we were looking early on for resources for me, as I was trying to learn some of these things, we didn't find much there. You know, I think we have books about highly sensitive people and how to, you know, get over shyness and things like that, but none of it was really applying to me and what my specific struggles were. So we decided that because we couldn't find what we were looking for, we could maybe help others by sharing some of what we had learned together.
So, though I add my two cents throughout the book, I think that was actually a perfect overview. So I'm going to leave it there.
Okay, fair enough. Well, I can relate probably for many reasons. One, in business, I decided that I wanted to be an emotions expert specialist. I was shocked by how little literature there was about emotions in the business world, when they're obviously rife all the time. So clearly you go there quite readily. Maybe this is particularly for Sarah in this case. Can you talk about your own relationship to emotions, your own emotions, and particularly maybe the term internalization, if you don't mind bringing that into the answer?
Yeah, for sure. I think I have a lot of trouble with recognizing my own emotions and processing emotions in real time, which often leads to me just ending up in a kind of a blank state until I can figure out what the emotion is that I'm experiencing and why. So it takes me time to process emotions, especially bigger emotions. And it can come across, and for a lot of autistic people have the same experience, it can come across as if I don't have any emotions, because in the moment, it's just so much for me to process that it comes out as being aloof or being blank and emotionless, when in fact, there's so much going on under the surface that it just can't come out. It's like a bottleneck situation going on. So for me, that ends up with doing a lot of internalizing. When I was younger, I would, you know, this term of kind of bottling things up and keeping them close inside because I didn't know how to get them out. And something that I do a lot now that has helped is writing things down just to get it out somewhere in the world so that it's not stuck inside in this kind of internalized spiral.
So I wanted to share a case in point. When we were first together, it was, you know, a young relationship and us having our communication difficulties and just whatever life was. And the emotional event or whatever was kicked off shut Sarah down for a good 2 hours of no words, not even a barely a tear, just completely frozen. And as somebody who likes to talk and communicate, that was an interesting experience of how Sarah dealt with her emotions. And then, of course, everything came out later, and it was lovely and wonderful. I went through a few boxes of Kleenex tissue boxes here. It was just to hold all of that emotion at once and then to try to let it go. That bottleneck was huge.
Sure. Well, you mentioned a couple of hours, because that was going to be my follow-on question to what Sarah had said, because you talked about a time delay. I'm sure the answer must vary, but is that two-hour delay that Larry, you just mentioned, is that kind of, I guess I'll say, typical? I mean, different circumstances must create different kinds of time delays.
Sure. I want to start that one. And just, No, it's no longer typical. And it speaks to Sarah's self-efforts at trying to understand her own emotions and how to succeed and really just how to live in this world. It's not really a healthy practice to get stuck. And I'll let Sarah answer the second part of it, but
sure.
No, not at all. It really has changed.
Yeah. And I think it also speaks to you, Larry, knowing that I can have this propensity to shut down like that. And so being able to take a step back and stop the emotional train before it gets to that point helps me also. I think it happened a lot more when I was a child, when I was growing up, and I didn't really know what was happening. But now, as an adult, it's easier for me to see it coming from a ways off. And so I can tell Larry, I need 10 minutes, and I'll go into the room by myself and have 10 minutes of quiet so that I can reset and not get to the point where I'm a non-functional for an hour or more. So that definitely helps.
And in an office setting, as opposed to when you're with Larry, do you also ask for those 2 minutes? I mean, how do you navigate those situations?
Yeah, it can be different in a work setting. Of course, everybody's work setting is different. I have been very blessed to have work settings where I manage my own time for the most part. So I can take a few minutes after a big meeting or, to prep before I know something is going to be more of an emotionally charged exchange. I'm able to take that time usually to either recover or prep myself.
And I want to throw in here that though I am what they say is neurotypical, though, that's a whole nother Pandora's box. I too, and I think just about everyone in this world, needs those moments. And what I've developed is I drink a cup of coffee and I just say, you know what? I have to go refill my cup of coffee. Even if I spilt it into the trash can, that, oh, look, it needs a refill. We all need that moment to recalibrate ourselves. And with Sarah, obviously it can be significantly bigger than what I might need to calibrate, but we all have that somewhere. It's just a trait that is a little bit more profound with Sarah.
Okay. To round out this part of the discussion on internalization, there was a wonderful comment in the book that said, Sarah wrote, "To me, my internal world is 90% of the world." Has that changed? It sounds like you've talked about things are easier and what might have been a 2 hour delay is 10 minutes. Is that 90%? Does that still hold?
Yeah, I think that for me, there's so much thought that goes into every single action, every single word. Now that I've been, that I've been alive for 30 plus years, I've gotten better at doing it a little bit faster, but there's still so many things happening behind the surface that I have to try and manage manually. Like so many people, I feel like do this, get to a point where they do this automatically. They can automatically read social situations or automatically know what to say next, or, they just kind of know where they're going and might need a little bit of a check-in here and there. I'm checking in with myself every single second. And it gets very tiring, but it also, I've been learning how to be able to automate some of that myself. I have to do it all manually instead of relying on my brain to do it automatically.
Okay. Makes sense to me. If I can move to another topic, but kind of related, because we're talking about those back and forth moments and whether it's done automatically or manually, there's lots to navigate. So I'm moving here kind of to, small talk, and you mentioned creating conversational sandwiches, which is a wonderful image. And you even brought in the role of humor and how that can have its own, whitewater rapid moments to try to navigate. So small talk and humor, if you don't mind maybe saying a bit on that front.
Yeah, sure. So for me, it always is helpful, because I'm doing everything manually, to have a framework to work from, because then I can go back to that framework and use that as my automatic process. So for example, for small talk, which is something that doesn't come naturally to me, and I think doesn't come naturally to a lot of people, I often will have like things in my back pocket, metaphorically speaking, that I can talk about when it comes to small talk. So, I write about in the book, if it's a Monday, I know that I can talk about a couple of things that just happened on the weekend. Or if it's a Thursday, I know I can talk about a couple of things that are coming up on the next weekend. I might just familiarize myself with the weather or with current events, just so that I have it as something that I can refer back to if I need to be in a small talk situation. I've learned that small talk is important for building a common ground with someone before you dive right into the real meat of what it might be that you need to talk about with someone, or if it's just a chance interaction, just to be able to connect with someone instead of, I'm perfectly happy standing in silence, but I know a lot of people find that awkward. So being able to put people at ease with that. You mentioned also the framework of making a sandwich. That's also helpful for me when we get into the flow of a conversation. Once you get through the small talk, then you start talking with someone. It helps me to think about being able to add a piece to the conversation and then purposely making myself stop and let the other person add a piece to the conversation, because otherwise, I would just let the other person talk over me and I would just listen, because I do love to listen. Or if it's something that I'm very passionate about, I might end up doing all the talking and I don't get any input from the other person. So it helps to have that framework to go back to.
Sure. And Larry, when you're at a party and a conversational sandwich is being made by Sarah, how do you help play chef?
Well, honestly, if we get to a point where she's making a sandwich to somebody, this conversation is sponsored by Subway.
Yes.
I will not, unless I have something to contribute, some cheese or whatever, that is Sarah's conversation. What I really want to talk about is that this notion that we call hit points, and Sarah wakes up every day and let's say it's 100 hit points. If she engages in a conversation, the small talk might take 15 or 20 of those hit points from her and just kind of wear her out a little bit. And then hopefully the larger conversation, the purpose, will restore some of those hit points, will make it a little bit easier for her to feel comfortable, to feel re-energized. But there is a cost to that small talk that not everybody experiences.
Mm-hmm. Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor's the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Sure. Well, I can admit I relate in the sense that my family moved to Italy when I was a six-year-old boy, and I found myself going to Italian first grade in a fishing village without knowing the language. So I could only do the math unit. So I sat there all day basically looking at my teammates or my classmates and trying to understand what was happening. And then I came back to St. Paul, Minnesota, and everybody thought I was a foreigner because I had European cut clothing and, you know, I sounded a bit different and so on and so forth. So finding small talk, finding continuity, finding common ground that you just mentioned, I've gone through that, and it does add its own stresses. It does make you very attentive to what's going on around you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So there's another part I wanted to move to. You talk about in terms of an ASD brain being a little bit more prone to what you called weak central coherence. If you can tell us about a couple aspects of that, a tendency to black and white thinking, lack of big picture thinking, any place else you want to go with that topic, but I think listeners would be interested.
Yeah. So there's the technical term is that kind of weak central coherence, which is being able to pull out the main point of something or find the most important thing or, you know, generalizing, and all of that are things that I have trouble with and that a lot of autistic people do have trouble with. For me, it really manifests in what you mentioned in terms of this tendency for black and white thinking, which is a kind of an all or nothing approach. For me, if something is not 100% right, then it's wrong. It's completely wrong. So, you know, that lends itself to a lot of perfectionism and a lot of this kind of all or nothing feel, which is just not. Life doesn't happen that way. It's not perfect. So being able to learn how to navigate some of the gray areas and be okay with something being only 85% okay, and still that being good enough and moving forward, that's been a real struggle for me. And I think, you know, a lot of when you talk about like big picture thinking in this context, it helps so much to be able to come out of the details, because my brain is, and a lot of people, we see so many of the details. Like I'm looking at the forest, but I don't know that there's a forest because I'm so overwhelmed by all of the trees. And so it doesn't even occur to me sometimes that I need to take a step back and that there is a forest to look at, and I need to know where that is in the bigger picture. So for me, it's a constant struggle to remind myself that I need to take a moment and understand what that bigger picture is, why I'm here, what's the most important thing, because then that gives me the ability to move forward through something instead of being stuck in the details.
I find that fascinating. I admit that as you were talking and explaining that, I remember once being in the Peruvian part of the Amazon basin and feeling completely immersed in my environment and trying to, you know, keep track of it and realizing very large insects were suddenly on my back and so forth. So it does give me a real feel for, you know, how you approach these things. That's interesting. Larry, was there anything there that you wanted to add? Because often in the book, there's what's called the two cents portion of the book.
Just a callback that what Sarah doesn't do is Sarah does not fake it until she makes it. And it talks about that confidence. And when Sarah says pulling out the big picture item and being able to focus, the more that Sarah is able to get into what she knows or what she can research, what she can learn, that's where she's going to be successful. If it's just fake it, just walk in like you own the place or you've done it 100 times, that's not a successful on road for Sarah.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And I imagine that must make it interesting when we move to what I wanted to talk about next, office politics, because there's a good deal of fakery sometimes, at least in some offices. And I've just published a book called Blah, 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 A Snarky Guide to Office Lingo, which is very much about trying to navigate implicit and explicit power structures. So you very rightly bring up in the book that some of the underpinnings of office politics and things that can be real challenges, particularly for you, Sarah, is trying to know the role or the impact of things like status and cachet and rapport. What can you tell us about those three factors and how you work with it?
Yeah, it's I don't know almost anything about either any of those three things because that's not something that I pick up on naturally at all. Actually, I want to throw this over to Larry because he's helped me so much with just learning what those things are and how to spot them, which I still struggle with.
Okay, fair enough. Yeah, Larry, what can you enlighten us with?
They're all very important to the people who value them. I don't think that they are probably the most important thing on how the work actually totally gets done. And I can't wait to read your book because I'm sure there will be some insights into how do you get through the fluff of getting everyone comfortable before you can get on point. And there's a favorite anecdote of Steve Jobs at Apple, where he walks into a conference room and somebody says, "The weather today," and he looks at him and all but throws him out of the conference room and says, "We don't have time for that. We're here at Apple to do this business." So there is definitely some culture. And I spent a lot of years as a consultant for the Army, the Army and the Air Force. There was very little rapport building during the day because it was structure, it was command. And that's very different than where we are in the real world. We're sitting here right now in a beautiful conference room and there's a water cooler across the way. And boy, if I hadn't watched Ted Lasso last night, then what would I talk about with those people?
Mm. Sure.
That's just a whole different dynamic.
Yeah. I would just add, I think it is important though, to some degree, and you know, it depends on what your work situation is, but I have found that some of the advice that Larry has given me in terms of making sure, like going out of my way to go and see somebody in person rather than like shooting off an email or even trying to pick up the phone, helps because you start to just develop a relationship with your coworkers, and that just makes things run a little bit smoother sometimes. Like if you run into a hiccup or if somebody misses a deadline or something, you have that relationship to fall back on. And that can be very helpful in a way that I never really understood before.
Yeah, no, I remember that point in the book and I thought it was a point well made that there can be a vast separation between an email and a phone call. I remember having a meeting at McDonald's and she said, we had to delay for just a moment. My boss in Germany misunderstood my last email, didn't pick up on the nuances. I now have to make an international phone call to save the situation and I'll be back to you shortly. And so she stepped out of the room to make the call. Let's move to your own relationship. There's a wonderful statement you say, valuing intentions over outcomes can help a lot. What do you mean by that, particularly in relationship to repair strategies? And I love this term, emotional reciprocity.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So in terms of our relationship together, Larry and I, because of the way that we communicate differently and we perceive the world differently, and this is going to happen for anybody who's in a relationship, but particularly in our case, because we are neurodiverse, miscommunication can happen a lot. And so being in a place where we both remember to value each other's intentions over the outcomes helps to just make that a little bit softer. It doesn't, it's not an excuse for the outcomes. The outcomes are still what they are and they may be painful. But knowing that the intention was good and not malicious does help when it comes to repairing, you know, what might have happened. I think, you know, when you talk about repairing strategies and emotional reciprocity, those are kind of technical terms, but really what they're getting down to is how are you working together to come to an emotional common ground?
Good intentions. This is all about, we start the day with good intentions. We want to be successful. We want to be good parents. We want to have good days. And when things don't always work out the way that we expect, how do you recover from that? How do you pivot and move forward? So just remembering the grander picture, remembering that I wanted to make that really nice meal. And yes, I ruined the rice this time, but that doesn't take away from the rest of the effort and the rest of the quality of the food.
Mm. And the fact that we're enjoying it together.
There you go.
Sure. And you communicate what the intentions were, I imagine, so that everyone understands. I mean, I was almost tempted. Last night I was watching an old Paul Newman movie, Cool Hand Luke, and I was thinking we could have used as the intro that moment where they say, what we have here is a failure to communicate, because mm-hmm. there are lots of failures to communicate in the land. A last question I wanted to go to. You mentioned at some point in the book, modeling emotional stability. And I certainly want to hear what some of your solutions or approaches are there, but I also wanted to grant some leeway, because I know from studying the Big Five personality traits myself, it's pretty amazing to the degree to which all of us as human beings are much less stable than we imagine we are. Mm. And so emotional stability is kind of the positive way of saying one of those five traits, which is neuroticism, which frankly can plague all of us. I'm curious as to what some of those solutions are, because I think everybody, you know, appreciates tips and tactics wherever they fall on spectrums in life in terms of seeking emotional stability.
Yeah, I think, and when we write about this specifically, I think it's in the parenting chapter where we're talking about, using your, being able to use your emotions as a tool, as a teaching tool, really. And modeling that ability to control your own emotions to a certain degree. But I think also being able to show your children, wherever they are on the neurodiverse or neurotypical spectrum, being able to show your children that you do have emotions, you are a human being, and yet they don't control you, and you can, especially when you're dealing with a child who might be emotional, being able to take that step back and let them see that they are affecting you, but that it's not the end of the world. You know, you do maintain that control, and you can model for them how they can start to have some of that control over their own emotions, which for any kid, you know, autistic or not, young kids are going to have big emotions to deal with.
So being able to nurture, it's like, so Sarah, for your birthday this year, you got an iPad that you can draw with. Mm-hmm. And that gives you some quiet time, some salvation, some opportunity to be restorative. Mm-hmm. And with kids, if it's, they go off and they read a book, or you're walking down the street, and I said earlier about coffee, going in and pouring yourself an extra cup of coffee, that finding ways to identify where you are emotionally, and both allowing the emotion to exist because it's true. And if you suppress it too much, then it's going to get bottled up and it's going to affect the rest of your day. But then finding ways to park it and put it off to the side so that you can continue and be successful. And a bad 15 minutes doesn't become a bad hour or a bad day or spiral as far as you want to go there with the snowball. That's very important.
Okay. Well, I want to thank you so much. I admit I'm a former poet, so I'm not sure how much central coherence I always have at times and whether that's my specialty, but there was lots of wonderful points in the book and different avenues it pursued from workplace to raising a child. And hopefully we cover those things. Is there one last comment? Maybe you want to make, one last insight to offer before we close the conversation?
I would love to share one of the things that we don't do, which is that we don't compromise, that we don't look at the day as 50-50 and who cooks and who cleans and who does this and who does that. We work together to be successful and to not only honor each other, but to identify and know what those traits are that we're bringing to the table. And I think that that really helps keep us grounded. And you know, on the best days, we really get to enjoy the fruits of our labor. But on the rough days, they're not quite as bad because we had those intentions and we worked together as best as we could to be successful.
Yeah, and that leads into the last point I would want to make, which is that we're better together. And that's something that Larry and I have used as a mantra since the beginning in terms of what is our bigger picture. That's our reminder of what's most important, the fact that we're together and we're better together. And I think that that applies more broadly as well. You know, when you think about neurodiversity and diversity in general and how we really need different minds and different perspectives to come together, and we're all better for it.
Okay. And indeed, this episode is entitled We're Better Together. And now we have a little more illumination as to why. I want to thank you both, Sarah and Larry. Our time is up. I'm your host of Dan Hill's EQ Spotlight. This has been episode number 85. My guest, Sarah and Larry Nannery. They are the co-authors of What to Say Next, Successful Communication in Work, Life, and Love with Autism Spectrum Disorder. If you've enjoyed today's show, please give it a rating or review on iTunes. You can find other episodes by going to my company's website at the obligatory 3 W's and sensorylogic.com, or the New Books Network. Type in the show's name and you'll find those previous episodes. Finally, I'd like to conclude every episode with an epigram. In this case, I took one from Johnny Seitz. He is an autistic tightrope artist in the movie Loving Lamppost, who said, "Stop thinking about normal. You don't have a big enough imagination for what your child can become." Until next time, be kind and stay safe.